This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
We live in a delicate world, and I think if we were honest, we'd recognize that sometimes we have a real difficult time with the language of the Bible because we're a product of this world. We've imbibed so much of how the world thinks that we often forget the issues we have when it comes to relating to God. And so that's one tendency, right? Our world may be more concerned with offending other people than they are about the fact that they've offended God. So that's one issue. On the other hand, there's some of us in this room who've grown up in church our entire lives. We read the stories of the Bible, and we forget that we have the same kind of tendencies that those Bible characters have. We tend to think that we're always the heroes because we believe the Bible. So, like, I read David and Goliath, and I think, well, I'm like David. Or I read this story today, and I'm going to think, well, I'm like Jonathan, because I believe this. I believe the Bible. I'm not like people in the world that deny this. And we forget that there's really only one hero in the Bible. There's only one person who gets it right all the time. There's only one person who accomplishes everything that he intends to do. And to the degree that anyone else gets that, it's a pointer to him. And so, in actuality, we're the Dumbos. We're the Sauls acting foolishly. None of us is living up to God's standards. Even the most righteous person in this room outwardly doesn't do enough good, model enough right, or merit enough to be impressive to God. There's none of us in this room who are that way. The best one of us is still a mess. So we've got issues. And we come today to a chapter in the Bible which shows an impossible battle scene. You might remember how that was set up last week and what we looked at in 1 Samuel 13. The army is small in number. It started out at 3,000. It's dwindled now to 600. The army has no weapons. So they have to go to the Philistine land to get all their weapons. That was at the end of chapter 13. They're led by a man who tends towards foolishness and cowardice rather than biblical wisdom. And so we continue in that story today. And in this, we have the whole issue of trying to relate, what is God trying to teach us through this battle scene? And I think the thing that, I mean, just trying to go up to the highest level, I think one thing that we can say pretty certainly is that one thing God wants us to see because of how this battle scene is described consistently in this passage is, it's called God saving his people. And that's something, hopefully, that we do have some relation to. That's something that we can understand a little bit. So God's going to use someone to do this, to save his people, but it's God saving nonetheless. So, by way of introduction today, do you have a category for a God who saves? And what is he saving you from? Or maybe to ask this better, what do you need saved from? So on one level, I'm wanting you to get honest about your issues today. And I'm inviting myself to get honest about the issues. That we have issues when it comes to relating to God. And every single one of us in this room has those kinds of issues. There are things that we need saved from. And this is just part of one of the major storylines of the Bible. So if you said, what's the greatest thing that happened in the Old Testament in terms of God saving people? It would be God rescuing his people out of Egypt. I mean, Charlton Heston acted this out for us, the Ten Commandments. I mean, this is what Hollywood decided to celebrate, you know, this act of redemption. So, I mean, this is the greatest act of redemption, and it's described as God saving his people, the greatest act in the Old Testament. And even in the New Testament, what's all of it about? So we have four gospel accounts, right? The gospel accounts are telling us the story of Jesus when he came to earth. And those gospel accounts, I think it's something like 60% of the content is devoted to the last week of Jesus' life. In John's gospel, it's even more pronounced. And why is that? Because that's where it's at. That's what he's doing. His act of saving is the thing that we're to be left with. In fact, Matthew introduces this in Matthew 1 by telling us that the reason he's named Jesus is he's going to save his people from their sins. So God coming to earth, taking on human flesh, living, dying, and rising again that we might be saved. That's what the whole thing's about. That's the whole point of the New Testament. And you want to study the book of Revelations, or whatever that is, the book of the revelation of Jesus Christ. You want to study that? You know what it's about? Jesus Christ and his glory forever. It's not about weird helicopters flying over the plains and bombing countries and stuff. It's God reigning forever, all over history. And he has the right to reign because he saved a people for himself from every tribe and tongue and language and nation. So this is what the whole Bible is about. So we get today to jump into a passage that just on the surface level seems like an Old Testament battle scene, like we're reading history, and this is history, but it's pointing us to something. It's pointing us to a God who saves, and that's how this passage is described. So this notion of saving is big. Has God worked salvation in your life? And where is this needed? So today, this passage is going to show a couple ways of living again. In the Old Testament context, we could generally describe these ways to live as the way of wisdom contrasted with the way of the fool. And these two ways of living are characterized by Jonathan and Saul. So God's given us a narrative. He's given us a story to get these things. And like I said, we have a lot to cover, 52 verses. So let's get ready to hear an amazing story and be curious about what is this showing us about the God who saves? What is this telling us about him? There's no one like him who saves and rescues people. And so I hope all of this, the chapter encourages you, and even deeper, I hope it calls you to respond. And so I invite you to join me today as we see two aspects of how God works salvation for his people. Two aspects of how God works salvation for his people. And again, 1 Samuel 14. So let's begin reading in verses 1, and we'll read down to verse 5 to start out. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let's go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah, in the pomegranate cave at Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men, including Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side and a rocky crag on the other. And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Senna. The one crag rose in the north in front of Michmash, and the other to the south in front of Geba. So this is God's word. Thanks be to God. Two aspects of how God works salvation for his people. And first of all, we see that God works salvation through people who trust him. God works salvation through people who trust him. Who trust him. This is such an obvious truth, but it's couched within this story. So right as the chapter begins, what we just read, the scene is set, right? One day, that's how the passage begins, that's really on that day. On the day that the battle shakes down that we read about in chapter 13. It's another kind of way of seeing. This is all happening in the same breath as chapter 13. And the contrast is set up. Jonathan says to his young armor bearer, "Let's go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." Now, by the way, armor bearer isn't just like his personal attendant or slave. I think we read that and we're thinking, oh, armor bearer, this was like some person that was too silly to fight and just needed to carry the armor into the battle. No, it's probably like the greatest fighter in the army, because that person was going to be fighting right next to the king's son. Just like Saul's armor bearer, that's a significant position. Probably the greatest warrior in the army is going to be closest. And we have that throughout the Old Testament. Like you read of David's mighty men. Those were the men who were closest to him. They were the best fighters. So, Jonathan is talking to this elite fighter, probably his bodyguard, and he says, let's go to the other side and take these people. And by contrast, with Saul, Saul is staying on the outskirts, kind of away from the battle in a pomegranate cave. He's got 600 men around him. So just kind of, you kind of just get the impression he's kind of laid back In fact, a lot of scholars believe this isn't just like a pomegranate cave. He's just literally sitting under the tree eating fruit while his son's going into battle. And look at the people that are around him in verse 3. He's with Ahijah, and we're told this is Eli's great-grandson. Do you remember that from earlier in 1 Samuel? This was the cursed priesthood. That they were doomed to fail. In fact, Ichabod, the mention of his name, should remind them, like, oh yeah, remember when he was born? Like, we went into battle and trusted the ark rather than God, and therefore the glory of God departed from Israel. And that's why he's named Ichabod. And that name's brought up here. We're also mentioned the name Phinehas, who was running that shady operation at the temple. And even Eli, who was letting it all go on. So it's almost like, you know, the writer is almost writing to us and saying, can you believe this? These are the people that he's hanging out with. So he's not only like not in battle, he's hanging out with these people. And then we go back to Jonathan, as the scene said in verses 4 and 5, describing the passes on each side. You kind of get the impression like two rocky crags. It's like a mouth that's getting ready to swallow Jonathan. And there's the teeth on each side. And the names of the crags, Bozez, that means slippery in Hebrew, and Senna means thorny. Okay, so he's going to pass through these crags. This is an impossible situation. And two guys are contrasted. So we jump into verse 6. Because you might be wondering, like, what made Jonathan so courageous if his dad's just a lazy bum? Where did this come from? Well, we get that in verse 6. So let's begin reading there down to verse 15. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, come, let's go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. And his armor bearer said to him, do all that's in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I'm with you heart and soul. Then Jonathan said, behold, we'll cross over to the men and we'll show ourselves to them. And if they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand. And this shall be the sign to us. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us, and we'll show you a thing or two. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed them after him. And that first strike with Jonathan and his armor bearer made killed about 20 men within, as it were, half a furrow's length in an acre of land. And there was panic in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled, the earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. So we get a sense of Jonathan's heart here, right? You get kind of this is a battle man. And his heart really comes out in verse 6, right? Let's go to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. So do you hear the kind of confidence he has in God? And that confidence isn't pride, right? He's not saying, hey, all we got to do is name it and claim it. God's for us, so let's just go beat these fools back. No, he says, listen, God can do this. I'm not sure if God's in it yet. But man, God can do this, and God doesn't need an army of 600 men that we've calculated. He doesn't need to know what kind of support we have. God can do this today, if he so chooses. So let's go see if God would be pleased to do this today. God may work through us, right? And he gets it. God doesn't need an army. He's God, and Jonathan's armor bearer is with him, so they cross over, and they show themselves. You can imagine the scene, like they're kind of crawling down, hiding in these crags. The Philistines can't see them, but then they come to kind of the bottom of this ravine, out of that side of the rocky crags, and show themselves, and then the Philistines, you know, the sign is if they invite them up, the battle's on. If they say, you stay there, we'll come to you, then Jonathan knows not to go up. So the attack isn't based on ingenuity or math, but just we're going to trust God and see if he's in it. And they proceed, and you get a sense of the tone in verse 12, right? Come up here, and we'll show you a thing or two, right? Here come the Hebrews. So Jonathan knew that it was of God, so he worked his way up the face of the crag, and about 20 were dead, and a panic came upon them. This was of God. So again, God is almost fighting here for the Israelites. Do you see the word repeated in verses 15 and 16, that word panic? There was panic, they trembled, there was a great panic. That's all the same word in Hebrew. So there's something going on here that's from God. God's causing them to fall into a panic. It was sent from God. God's very much in the midst of this. And Jonathan seems to be the warrior that all Israel needs. He almost, like, he's the king they need. Like, they need a king like this who's going to go mop up the Philistines. But in verse 16, the story turns, where while all this is happening, meanwhile, here's what Saul's doing in verse 16. So let me read down to verse 23. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, count and see who's gone from us. And when they had counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. For the ark of God went at that time with the people of Israel. Now while Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult of the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, nah, don't worry about it. Withdraw your hand. Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and went into the battle. And behold, every Philistine's sword was against his fellow, and there was great confusion. Now the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Levites who were with Saul and Jonathan. And likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth-Aven. So meanwhile, Saul looks and he can see something's going on. The Philistines, things just aren't normal. And again, it's probably not Saul looking. He's got men for this type of thing that are keeping watch. They kind of inform him. And rather than just saying, hey, Philistines are, let's go, let's support. God's doing something, let's move. He does a quick count. So, I mean, he's quickly counting 600 people. Have you ever tried to count 600 people? And they figure out that there's two guys gone and it's his son. Like, how did he figure that out? Like, why was he not thinking of that first in the first place? It's just crazy. So Jonathan and his armor bearer are missing. And so they say, bring the ark. So back to this crazy ark logic. So, like, what's the ark going to do? Like, go into battle and fight for them? Haven't we been down this road once? It doesn't work. The ark's not like a rabbit's foot. So they still don't get it, right? And so rather than seeking the Lord, Saul basically says to the priest, withdraw your hand, forget this seeking God stuff. Let's fight. And God continues to fight. Every Philistine sword is working against him. Great confusion. The Hebrews, again, note that, who had defected to the other side to save their skin, turned out to be with the Israelites. And all the people in hiding came out as well. They chased the Philistines away. And the summary in verse 23, the Lord saved Israel that day. The Lord did this. So do you see the contrast? That God saved through the one who trusted him. God worked through the simple faith of Jonathan. Saul was hiding. Saul didn't even bother seeking the Lord on this. God worked to rescue his people through the humble trust of Jonathan. He just said, God can do this. Man, we don't need like more people than them. We got God. He can do this. And God was the one who saved. So just like we saw in chapter 13, all that was required was the humble recognition that God would do this. Faith. God works salvation through those who trust him. I mean, this is a rhythm throughout the kings. So if you read all the historical literature, so if you read 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, It's almost as if God is looking to find hearts that are fully devoted to Him. Understanding who He is and what He does. And over again, throughout the Bible and even in today's world, over and over again, the kings will rely on their ingenuity. They'll rely on their math. They'll rely on political prowess to win the day. And they'll forget that it's the Lord who fights. And that happens all the time, even today. They forget that the battle isn't merely flesh and blood. So who are we going to trust? Who are you going to trust? So I mentioned earlier in the service this Equality Act that might be a threat to freedom. Who are we going to trust in that? Politicians? Is that where our hope is? That if we can just get the right person in office, this is all going to be fixed? Is that really what your hope is in? We had 2 years where Republicans had Congress, Republicans had the presidency, we couldn't defund Planned Parenthood, we had all the votes. Are we going to put our trust there? So, I mean, what emerges in your life? Do you really trust the God who saves? When you're hard-pressed, are you turning to God? When you're faced with the impossible situations, are you leaning into Him with a humble faith? That God may rescue. God has the ability here to rescue. God can fix all this like that. He doesn't need infinity stones. He can just snap and it can happen. God can do this. But no, I think we drift into ingenuity. Like, here's what we could do. If we worked it this way, then we could fix this. Or we have more money. Or we have a bigger lobbying group. Or we have more intelligence. Or we have a better work ethic. Or we have a way of seeing the world that will fix all this. And we put all of our confidence there. So again, maybe even an overpronounced hope in elected officials to do this work. Saul failed his people. David failed his people. Solomon failed his people. All the kings of Israel failed their people. All of our presidents, all of our leaders have had failings. We cannot put our ultimate trust there. Now, God can use them, just like He used Jonathan. Right? So that's the tension. I'm not saying, well, God doesn't need any of that then. And I'm saying on one level, yeah, God doesn't need any of that. But we have the opportunity to vote. You should vote. You have the opportunity to use your voice. You should use your voice. Just don't put all your hope there. God can do this. God can fight. God can win the day. His will be done. So that's a challenging question I was thinking of this week, Luke 18. We have this parable kind of on prayer. And here's the conclusion of it. When the Son of Man comes, will He find faith on the earth? Is He going to find that? Like, if Jesus returned right now, would He find people who, man, I'm not worried about this. God's in control. Is He going to find faith on the earth? If God showed up tonight at my house, would He find faith in my house? So this is the question of this passage. Or is He going to find a bunch of people putting all their hope in government, hope in military might, hope in money, hope that we have more numbers than our opponents do? That was Saul's problem, right? Let's take a quick count. Who's with us? God's with you. That's enough, right? That's what Jonathan's saying. You know, God can do this. God can do this. God may be in this. Let's go. So, This is the first aspect of this passage of the God who saves. Man, oh, to have a faith like Jonathan. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. It may be that the Lord will work for us. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. God works salvation through those who trust him. So today, you may be here and you may believe, but pray and ask God, help my unbelief. I'm not trusting you enough. I'm a worried mess about all that's going on in this world. Give me a trust in you. My hope ultimately is in you. So that's the first aspect here. God works salvation through those who trust him. Secondly, and finally, another aspect of how God works salvation for his people in this passage is that God overcomes the actions of fools. God overcomes the actions of fools. So the rest of chapter 14 is really the story of how Saul snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Okay, so the battle's won. God has the Philistines routed. And now let's see what Saul's going to do to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Saul's going to get in the way. And rather than celebrating and running in what God has done, we continue in verse 24 where we read of an oath that Saul made. So begin reading with me in verse 24 and we'll read down to verse 30. The men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day. So Saul laid an oath on the people, saying, "Cursed be the man who eats food until it's evening, and I am avenged on my enemies." So none of the people had tasted food. Now when all the people came to the forest, behold, there was honey on the ground. And when the people entered the forest, behold, the honey was dropping, but no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. So he put out the tip of his staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes became bright. And then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. And Jonathan said, "My father's troubled the land. See how my eyes have become bright because I tasted a little of this honey? How much better if the people had eaten freely today the spoil of their enemies that they found, for now the defeat among the Philistines has not been great." So Saul's oath. On one level, we get the oath, right? We got to win this battle. So don't worry about filling your tummies. Just get to work. Go win this battle. But we see the wrongness of this in verse 24. That the men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day. And were given, now we know, the rest of the story, right? Here's why they were hard-pressed, because they had a doofus making stupid oaths. Like, nobody better eat today because we got to fight. You know, this is crazy. That's why they were hard-pressed and distressed, because of Saul's oath. And listen to the oath. "Cursed be the man who eats food until it's evening, and I am avenged on my enemies." Right? God's not on the horizon here. This isn't like some holy war. This is about Saul. My men aren't going to eat because we're going to fight. This isn't about God. It's about Saul. So the people saw the honey dripping. No one dared to touch it because of the oath. Jonathan hadn't heard this, remember? While everyone else was hanging out and chilling at Pomegranate Tree, Jonathan was out actually taking the war to the Philistines, right? He was out there with a faith saying, "God can do this." And so he puts out his staff, Jonathan does, refreshes himself with honey, his eyes become bright. And that's pretty interesting, right? His eyes become bright in the sense physically, right? I think it refreshed him, but I think his eyes were opened to the foolishness of what his father had said, the foolishness of the oath. And when he was told, "You shouldn't have done that, your father strictly charged us," the people were faint, and Jonathan's eyes helped him to see what he says in verse 29. "My father has troubled the land. See how my eyes became bright, how much better if people had eaten freely, for now the defeat hasn't been great." By the way, there's two other times in the Old Testament where people are said to trouble the land. One was Achan, when he sinned so that the people couldn't defeat Ai, right? Or Jericho, right? Well, right after that, Achan, his sin, yeah, after Jericho. So they lost the battle, and he had troubled Israel with his sin. And then it was used by Elijah. Remember that with King Ahab? When Elijah's going to take on the prophets of Baal, Ahab introduces and says, "Well, how are you doing, you troubler of Israel?" So we have like two notorious people, like Achan's sin and then King Ahab. These are not the kind of people you'd want to identify with, and that's where Jonathan puts his father's oath. This isn't good company. Jonathan recognized there was a better opportunity for victory than what the oath had cost. And in a remarkable turn, the passage continues in verse 31 on the heels of this oath as Saul breaks his own oath. Look at verse 31. Down to verse 35. They struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, and the people were very faint. And the people pounced on the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slaughtered them on the ground. And the people ate them with the blood. And then they told Saul, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And he said, "You've dealt treacherously. Roll a great stone to me here." And Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Let every man bring his ox and his sheep and slaughter them here and eat. Do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.'" So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night, and they slaughtered them there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. So this is a long stretch, just so you get a sense of it. Michmash to Ajalon was about a 20-mile stretch, okay? And people are forbidden to eat. So imagine that. I mean, most of us can't go from Hutch to Burton without stopping at Quick Shop. These people are fighting a battle over 20 miles, and they're forbidden to eat. So the people were very faint. We're told that again. And so they pounce on the spoil. They slaughter sheep and oxen and calves. And they did that on the ground. They didn't let the blood drain out properly, according to the Levitical law. So according to the Levitical law, the blood of these animals was to be drained, Leviticus 3 and Leviticus 7. Saul hears of this. So Saul builds an altar to, kind of, he builds the barbecue pit for these people, right? Don't be eating. I know you're famished. I don't know why. You know, he's never going to admit why they're famished. But here's an altar. Let's roast the stuff here and do it right. So his oath led them to breaking God's law. And now it seems like he's almost breaking his own oath as the battle isn't over yet. This is the foolishness playing out here. And the passage continues even more. Now we have to deal with Jonathan. So beginning in verse 36 down through verse 46, here's what we read. Then Saul said, "Let's go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let's not leave a man of them." And they said, "Whatever seems good to you." But the priest said, "Let's draw near to God here." And Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But God did not answer him on that day. And Saul said, "Come here, all you leaders of the people, and know and see that sin has arisen today. For as the Lord lives who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But there wasn't a man among all the people who answered him. And then he said to all Israel, "You shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan my son will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said, "O Lord God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? If this guilt is in me or in Jonathan my son, O Lord, give God of Israel, give Urim. If the guilt is in your people, Israel, give Thummim." And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. Then Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and my son Jonathan," and Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, this is his firstborn son, "Tell me what you've done." And Jonathan told him, "I tasted honey with the tip of my staff that was in my hand. Here I am. Kill me. I will die." And Saul said, God do so to me and more also. You shall surely die, Jonathan." Then the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who has worked this great salvation in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So the consequences of breaking the oath. Saul says, "Okay, let's finish this. Let's plunder these Philistines all night long." And everyone agrees, just whatever. I mean, it's not a very enthusiastic response from these people he starved to death to avenge his enemies. They're like, "Yeah, well, whatever seems best to you, king." So everyone agrees. They're willing to follow what Saul says, except for the priest, who says, let's see what God thinks about this. So Saul inquires of the Lord, but God doesn't answer. And now Saul's getting frustrated and lashes out in bravado. Who messed this up? Not realizing the part that he played in making the lives of his people difficult. So he makes another oath. As the Lord lives, who saves Israel, this person will die. And again, the people, they're not saying, well, Jonathan did it. Yeah, kill him. They're not saying a word, right? Both God and now the people are silent. And so he breaks them up. He casts lots using the Urim and the Thummim. And these were kind of like divine ways of determining God's will in the Old Testament law that were carried in the priest's ephod. And Jonathan was taken. So Saul asked Jonathan to come clean, and he does. I ate some honey with my staff that was in my hand. Here I am. I'll die. And it's preposterous, right? The whole point of this story is, this is preposterous. This is Saul's fault. Can this guy just take leadership for 5 seconds and just say, listen, I messed up. I've sinned against God. I made an oath I shouldn't have had. You know, forgive me. Priests, come. Let's absolve this. You know, whatever. Just not on the table at all, right? It's somebody else's fault. Who kept me from avenging my enemies? Who ate today over this 20-mile stretch when we were killing them? You know, it's all, you know, the fact that they sinned by violating the law was his fault. And Saul vows again, right? It's in the midst of this preposterousness, Saul vows again, God do so to me and more also. You'll surely die, Jonathan. And the people have to rescue him. The people helped Saul see that Jonathan wouldn't die because he's been an instrument of God for their salvation. And the passage ends, Saul quit pursuing and the Philistines went home. So when we take this whole episode, we see the contrast between God's agenda and ours. That's what's going on for Saul. God had an agenda. God was routing these Philistines. And Saul had to make it about him. He had to get in the way. He had to mess this up. And as a result, we have no resolution to this whole Philistine thing. So the passage ends with an epilogue. And this is strange because we still have chapter 15 to come. And there's still more of Saul's reign, but it's really going to pick up steam here in the next couple weeks. Chapter 15 is really about being a foil to the story about David. But here's the epilogue. Beginning in verse 47. When Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. And he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malki-Shua. And the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merib, and the name of the younger, Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner the father of Abner, and Abner was the son of Abiel. There were hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or valiant man, He attached him to himself. So this is the epilogue. This is kind of the verdict of history. He was a military leader. We get a sense of his children, his wife, army commander, other mighty men. Hard fighting with the Philistines all those days. So you might know that for Samuel 31, that's how Saul's going to die, in a battle with the Philistines. So when Saul found someone strong, he attached himself to that man. And today in this story, I mean, this is kind of the end of Saul's reign. I mean, this is, all the rest of it's going to be about David being anointed king, taking the throne. We do have to deal with chapter 15, but again, that's kind of, I think, pointing to something different. God has to overcome the actions of fools to save his people. And it's just a reminder that Yahweh, or the God of the Bible, the covenant-keeping God of the Bible, isn't looking for people who have their act all together. He's just looking for those who trust him, who follow him, and who do what he says. I mean, back to chapter 13, that's the whole thing, right? Just doing what God says, having a confidence in him and trusting him. One writer put it this way, covenant obedience matters more than vocational achievement. So what should have been more important to Saul should have been God rather than avenging his enemies. He was more interested in vocational achievement than he was about just that covenant obedience. And that's what got him into all this trouble. It might be the case for you too. Maybe you're so wrapped up in vocational achievement, doing something with your life. And you're, well, if I do this, it's going to get in the way of me following God the way I need to. Yeah, anytime those two are at odds, it's easy, you can easily step into the way of the fool. We can't forget God. We have to trust and obey Him. We have to have a faith that looks up to Him. Now, Jonathan, in his faithfulness, won't be king because of the foolishness of his father. And I think Jonathan's okay with that. I mean, you read through the rest of 1 Samuel, you're going to see Jonathan's pretty okay with that. And I think it's because his eyes are on the Lord. His eyes aren't wrapped up in getting the kingdom. His eyes are on God. And in the moment, he's not maneuvering all the circumstances of life for personal gain. He's just faithfully serving God no matter what it means in terms of achievement or advancement. So we're getting a glimpse of what it looks like to be a man of God's own choosing. Someone who's going to rely on God and not foolishness. So God overcomes the actions of the fool for the good of his people. So in conclusion, that's our outline today. Two aspects of how God works salvation for his people. He works salvation through people who trust him, and he overcomes the actions of fools. I love how Tim Chester brings closure to this chapter. It's really helpful to me. Here's what he says. The focus on this section is Saul's failure as a king. And that theme comes to its climax in chapter 15. But here, Jonathan is a foil to his father. Saul acts in fear. Jonathan acts in faith. So Jonathan is an example to us, but we must not miss the challenge. In faith, we can attempt brave things for God. But Jonathan's more than an example. He is also a pointer to Jesus. And we must not miss the thrill. We can be brave and have faith because Jesus has won the victory by descending to the cross. He's gone through the jaws of death, and death consumed him. But he's risen again to overcome sin and death. In 1 Samuel 14, we're not to place ourselves in Jonathan's shoes. Jesus is the one who stood there, cosmically and finally. We're called to follow. We're called to trust the Son who takes us through death into life and to trust Him enough to walk behind Him. So are we going to follow Him? Are we going to trust God? So today, that's the simple call. Let's be people of faith. Because of what Jesus has done, we can have a big faith like Jonathan did. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul concludes that because of all that Jesus had done in resurrecting from the dead, the concluding word is we should give thanks to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. And that's what's ours, through Jesus. Do you believe that? Do you believe that the victory is yours because of Jesus Christ our Lord? Let's have a faith that looks up to Him. Let's have a faith that looks to Him and all that He's accomplished, that we may glorify and enjoy Him forever.